Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in New York and played the flute. She's been a star holding key leadership positions with many of our nation's most prestigious orchestras and cultural organizations, including the Boston Symphony Orchestra, the Boston Pops, the Hollywood Bowl, and the New York City Ballet. In April of 2004, she became the president and executive director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Her name? Ann Parsons. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760, WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Ann Parsons, the president and executive director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Ann, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Gosh, my childhood and my parents. Well, I guess I directly think about music in my life since I was a child. Music always had a profound influence on me, and my parents brought that to me. My father loved jazz, and I can remember him coming in from the city. We lived in New York, and he would go to Sam Goody Records, and he'd bring me records, jazz records. And to balance that, my mother wanted me to know about classical music. So she would play the piano and play Debussy and Ravel and Beethoven and Mozart at home. And my brother, 5 years older, he was a wonderful musician. He played the trombone. And we all sang. I also had a great uncle who was a music teacher in Evansville, Indiana, in high school, a high school music teacher, and he did Broadway shows every year with his school. So every summer, I would learn the Broadway show that he was doing in his school. And so when I think about my family, I think about music, they all shared that gift with me, and I was brought up in a house of incredible song and music and joy.
What did your mom do and what did your dad do?
My mom was a teacher. She didn't really want to be a full-time teacher. She was part-time on and off when I was growing up. She really wanted to be a mom. She wanted to be at home and take care of us and look after things. My father worked a lot. We lived, as I said, in New York in Westchester County, and he commuted into the city. He worked in Wall Street, and so his hours were long, and I often didn't see him for dinners, but we spent lots of time together on the weekends and other times.
What did you learn from your mom, and what did you learn from your dad?
Well, I think about my mom very fondly. She's still alive. My father's not, sadly, but she and I speak a lot about the fact that she was less independent than maybe she wanted to be, and I felt that I could learn from that, and so from a very early age, I remember thinking that independence was going to be very important for me, and not in a negative way, but in a positive way, that I would be able to always stand on my own two feet, make good decisions, and go after my dreams.
How was it you took up the flute? Why the flute?
The flute was a choice in fourth grade. They came to the class. The music teacher came. They put all the instruments out on the table: clarinets, trumpets, flutes, violins, drums, and I signed up for the drums. And I went home and I told my parents that I was going to be a drummer. And they looked at me and they said, "No, you're not." I said, "What do you mean, no, I'm not?" Speaking of independence, they said, "Let's rethink that." And so again, while wanting to be independent, my parents were guiding, and my father said, "You know, what about the clarinet or the flute?" So I said, "Well, okay, let me go back and look at this." So I went back and I picked the flute. And I played the flute all the way through college. It was my friend.
In certain cultures, parents expect children to play a musical instrument. It's just part of growing up. What does that do for the child?
I think I'll just take it from a personal perspective. It gives you discipline. It helps your brain function better. I played the piano probably before the fourth grade. And that was a very fundamental way of building a skill set beyond reading and writing. It was just another language. And I didn't stay with the piano. I really focused on the flute, but I did overlap for a while. And I do think that in an individual way, it gives you that discipline. It is also gives you the opportunity for playing an instrument to be part of a community, which is a string quartet or a band or an orchestra, or if you're a singer, a choir. So music and being as a young person growing up, it gives you a social opportunity as well.
You've said in the past that one of the many things your parents did for you was they encouraged you and they let you make decisions and make mistakes.
Yeah.
Rick Snyder was here a month or two ago of Ardesta, and he said that was one of the greatest things his parents gave him. Talk about parents letting kids make decisions and make mistakes.
Well, I think it builds responsibility, and it's never too soon to think about being responsible. And young people particularly are very smart and very agile and adept at learning if we give them the chance to. And I think that when we protect people too much and make too many decisions for them, they don't learn as much. We all know that the greatest learnings in our life come from difficulty and from sometimes awkward moments or uncomfortable moments or unhappy moments. And we think about them, we're reflective, and we learn. So young people are the same as the rest of us. And my parents saw that while they wanted to protect me and often did protect me, they also let me learn by experiencing things myself and then asking me questions afterwards.
What did you want to be when you were a kid?
This is a very funny answer. It's funny to me and probably funny to most people who know me. I wanted to run an airport. I don't remember if I told Jim Nicholson this story. I think I did when I first met him. But it was funny that I don't know why I wanted to run an airport. I liked airplanes. I liked the busyness of it. And I liked the idea of managing something. Very early on, I knew I wanted to manage. And why an airport, I suppose we'll leave that to the psychiatrists.
We're talking to Ann Parsons, who's held positions as orchestra manager, general manager, now president and executive directors, and we'll ask her the difference in those positions. I'm Jack Prasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Prasula.
Welcome back. We're with Ann Parsons, who's held positions as orchestra manager of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, general manager of the Hollywood Bowl, general manager of the New York City Ballet, and now president and executive director. And what do you do in those different jobs?
Well, I was 25 when I became the orchestra manager of the Boston Symphony, and with that came managing really all aspects of the Boston Pops. I didn't manage all aspects of the Boston Symphony because there was an artistic administrator who worked with the conductors and decided what they would play. And my job, once they figured out what they wanted to play and when they wanted to play it, was to make it happen. And I also looked after the union contracts, the orchestra particularly, but also the stagehands. And I managed television shows and recordings and tours, and I was the logistics person and I was the people person. And that was a terrific job for a 25-year-old. It was a little daunting. Every once in a while, I had people at least twice and sometimes nearly three times my age that I was supervising. So it was challenging, but it was fun. And it prepared me for more of a management role. It was a large organization, and it was an excellent organization. And because of all those activities, I really learned a lot about operations and management and enjoyed it and didn't really want to move on. But when the opportunity to go to the Hollywood Bowl came up, I was able to take my work in the Boston Pops, which was more in the artistic side as well as the operations side. In other words, I worked directly with John Williams. We decided what we were going to play, when we were going to play it. Then we toured, we made recordings, we made television shows. The balance between the two and my interest in jazz, which I told you about from my childhood, all came together when they said, we need someone to go out and run the Hollywood Bowl, which is an 18,000-seat amphitheater that runs for 3 months. and has this mixture of pops, jazz, and classical music. It's the home of the LA Philharmonic, and we were starting a new orchestra. So they said, come out and start this popular orchestra called the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. Restarted. It had been an orchestra in the 50s, and it had gone away, and the LA Philharmonic had been playing there. So I was, the change from orchestra manager to general manager was that I was responsible for the 3-month summer season. And again, I worked for the LA Philharmonic, so I didn't raise the money and I didn't sell the tickets, but I was responsible for all the artistic programming and the execution of the programs and running that facility, which was a county-owned facility and a park. So I also worked restoring the facility. We had several bond issues that were granted to us, and we renovated up, used about $25 million of that money to renovate the facility, which was also fun. So I had a much bigger job at the Hollywood Bowl, and I did that for about 8 years. And I was managing a lot more people and a lot a vaster organization. And so interestingly, when I went to New York, to the New York City Ballet to be the general manager, the work of running the company was very much the same, but the scope was different because I was went back to a smaller theater, although it was at Lincoln Center. It was a large theater for a theater there. Running a dance company is very different than running a musical organization. And I think we had 8 or 9 unions to work with in New York. So again, I did a lot of the same kind of work, and the artistic side was different because choreographers and the artistic director of the organization, who was Peter Martins, made all the decisions, and I worked directly with him and for him. And it was terrific, actually, for the first time in my life, an artistic person ran the organization that I was working for. And I know that people think that artistic folks often and maybe always do that, but I can assure you that they almost never do it. That the person running the organization is in an administrative position, and the artistic person, particularly in music, comes in and out. But in a dance company, that's not the case. And so my 6 years at New York City Ballet were particularly rewarding because of that partnership with an artistic person who was full-time, really 24/7. In fact, his wife was in the company, his son was in the company, and his stepson entered the company when I was leaving, and his daughter was quickly, who was, I think, my daughter's age at that time, 6, quickly learning to be a ballerina all by herself. So it was very much a family affair.
Why is the Boston Pop so well known and so famous?
Well, that's a very good question. In commercial terms, it's brand identity. They figured out how to create a product that was unique to them. It has to do with the formula, the three-part formula of classics, concerto, and very, very popular contemporary tunes in that order. And it was about the way they presented it, and with the tables and the food and the drinking and the fun and the color of the jackets and the everything about the way they presented and the way they still present what they do has historically been recognizable. They were on television. Everybody knew across the country and around the world what the Boston Pops was. And they stayed pure to that. And they stayed pure to it, but they always kept it contemporary. The third was about what was completely current, whether it was the Beatles or, what's a good example today?
Who's the current
I have
kid
no
American
idea.
Idol?
Exactly, Clay Aiken or Jennifer Holliday or what, whoever was doing it.
How did you ever get from the New York City Ballet to the Detroit Symphony Orchestra?
Well, everybody knows this story now, Jack. Jim Nicholson, my friend, my chairman, my boss, he called me up many times, and he was very enticing, and more than that, he was persistent in the beginning, and he finally got me to come and visit the Detroit Symphony and visit Detroit, and that was key. Key was coming here and seeing it and experiencing it and talking to people. And but Jim was and is the reason I'm here.
When we come back, we'll ask Anne about living in New York, Boston, L.A., and now Detroit. and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Ann Parsons. Ann, you've been in Detroit, you and your family, for 3 years.
Yes.
Talk about Detroiters.
Detroiters. Well, Detroiters are very special to me, having lived, as you've seen and we've talked about, on the East Coast, on the West Coast. I find the depth of the people here to be really extraordinary. The care and the warmth, the concerns that they express, the seriousness with which they think about our issues, the fierce loyalty, I think, to the city and to the community, even when dealing with differences or issues of maybe conflict or concern, there is a passion about our community here that I find very special and very attractive, because living in some of these other cities, you have you don't really have all those qualities so often confronting you as you deal with people, and certainly in business and also in pleasure.
Let's talk about Jim Nicholson.
I'd love to.
The chairman of the board.
Yes.
Of the DSO.
Yeah. Jim, he's my hero, and he's a good friend. He and Ann have become very good friends to our family, and he's supportive, but he's one of the great leaders that I've ever met. He doesn't just talk about what he's going to do; he acts on it. He's when he's in the room with you talking about your problems, or your dreams. Either way, he's with you 100%, and he's thoughtful. And yet he doesn't micromanage. He's not there to tell you what to do. He's there to help you figure out what needs to be done and help you do it. And I think of him as somebody that that everyone could learn from. And I know that he is all over this city in a wonderful way. He has taken on a lot of leadership roles, and people who are lucky enough to work with him know what I'm talking about. He's just very 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 special.
When you were named president in 2004, there was a $2 million deficit, and Maestro Jarvi had just announced he was retiring after a 15-year tenure.
Yes.
How did you address those challenges?
We thought about how to set a course of action early on, and we thought about it as a team with Jim and other leaders in the board and the staff and the orchestra, and we knew that the financial picture of the orchestra was strained. So everybody worked together to manage expenses and to hold the line on expenses, in fact, to cut expenses. And a lot of that cost cutting had happened before I arrived. So the organization had really taken stock and said, again, under Jim's leadership, this is what we can afford. And then what else do we need to do? And in addition to holding the line on expenses. So while I looked for ways to help the organization continue to do that, our goal to grow earned revenue and to sell more tickets and to have less empty seats, paired with the need to raise more money from more people, and in some cases raise more money from some of the same people, but to grow our contributed revenue base, that was also key. And so those three areas have been the focus of our attention. And we have been doing strategic planning, and we continue that to look at where the organization wants to go and dreams of going. And we believe that it's critical to be dreamers, and we're doing that, and we're acting on it. We just announced a festival 8 days in June. It's all about thinking about ways that we can transform ourselves and be innovative and creative and have fun and provide something to the community that's different and new and fresh. And we think these are ways to stabilize the organization, actually.
We're talking to Ann Parsons, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with Ann Parsons. Ann, the president and executive director of a major symphony orchestra.
You keep reminding me of that.
What do you do all day?
What do I do all day? Boy, that's what my husband would like to know. I'm in a lot of meetings, talk to a lot of people. I like to have lunches and dinners whenever possible, connecting with our patrons or our donors or our artists. But I also have very strict rules about balancing that with my family. I have a husband for 20 years, and I want that to be 20 more years, and a beautiful daughter, 9 and a half. And it's very important that I spend time with them. So I do try to get home some nights. But there are many weeks where that's a struggle because there's something happening almost every night. And when there's a performance or a lecture or a program of some kind, I want to be there. So my nights can be work, but that's often the pleasure side of work. My mornings may start as early as, they start with my daughter taking her to school. Again, I'm sure you're not interested. You weren't asking about my personal life, but I must insist on prioritizing that. And taking my daughter to school is one of the things that I love to do. In Grosse Pointe, she's at public school there, and in Defer, and there are no buses in Grosse Pointe, as you probably know. But it's nice. We take her to school as a family, and then we go home, and I get ready to work, and I come into work, and then I'm usually booked from 9 until either performance time, or if it's one of those nights when I'm lucky enough to go home and have dinner with my family.
Talk about the role of the conductor.
Well, conductors conduct for sure. That's the primary role. And we currently have a principal guest conductor and artistic advisor in Peter Ungen, and he is playing an administrative and planning role as well as a conducting role with us. And that's that we're in our first year of that. He certainly will continue next year, and we're already making plans for 08 or 09. So there are most conductors we work with simply plan a program, come work with the orchestra, conduct the program, and leave. And that's what a guest conductor does. And they create music and give that as a gift over to the audience, and that's their job. A conductor who has responsibilities with an organization does a lot more. So I don't know if that's part of what you want to talk about, but
please.
The role of an artistic leader in an organization can take many shapes and forms. The orchestra itself has a lot of responsibility in taking care of things like auditions, who's going to be in the orchestra, select. They have a very detailed process that spells out in the union contract, but it's really for them to work out amongst themselves how they'll select members. And they present finalists generally to an artistic leader, and traditionally a music director, but in this case to our artistic advisor, Peter Ungen. And then they work together to make a selection. So personnel management is one aspect of the work that's done by a conductor traditionally. And then certainly repertoire selections and soloist selections and any themes that we might want to create, that's a big part of what someone will do in overseeing an entire season. So again, we've just announced a season for next year that Peter Ungen has supervised. And there, because we've had a partner to work with on that season, I think it's given us the opportunity to take extra steps and be more creative and go with his inspiration, as opposed to taking guest conductors who come in and feed us ideas and try to weave that together in a quilt, which can be interesting and beautiful, as quilts often are. But it's better when there's a bigger plan to the quilt and there's something that ties it all together. So artistic leadership does that.
For the last 7+ years, we've been blessed in this town to have guest conductor, the maestro, Thomas Wilkins.
Yes.
Talk about Maestro Wilkins.
Tom is salt of the earth. Tom is a beautiful person. He's a kind, generous, caring artist who shares his gift not just with the orchestra and the staff and the family, which he does generously, but certainly with every audience he comes in contact with. He makes sure people leave the concert hall or leave the park or leave the meeting that he's in. Better people, more inspired people, more thoughtful people, because he gets you thinking, and he gets right inside you when he talks to you. Now, he has been conducting our young people's concerts on Saturdays and our educational concerts, which are during the week. We do for 15 of them or so for the school systems. And he's been doing those, and he's developed a rapport with those kids. They know him, and he knows them. And so there's continuity. But in spite of that continuity, or in addition to the continuity, he offers his hand out to every new person who ever walks in the building, and often says, "Have you ever been to a concert before? Don't be afraid. Come in. Let me embrace you." And that's what he does every single time that he's conducting a concert. And it's not just with his words, although his words are very important. It's the way he carries himself. It's the way he is, how easy he is with himself and with others. And it's his passion for the music and his longing to share that passion with others and have them feel it and have them leave the concert hall having been uplifted by the concert or by the performance.
What makes a world-class musician?
Well, I'm not sure I can really fully answer that question, because I think that it's subjective. I think every person will have a different answer. I am interested in somebody who has very high standards for themselves and others, and who seek excellence. But I also think that there are lots of other things for me that come into play. World class is someone who's open-minded and who is willing to take risks and willing to try new things and be creative. Having said that, there are specialists who are also world class who don't do any of those things, and it isn't that one can't respect that. So I think it's a very difficult question to answer definitively. But and in fact, we debate that phrase "world class" internally about whether that's even important. Isn't really seeking excellence the most important issue? And I think that seeking to be excellent one's yourself, and also to hold others to a standard of excellence, is makes you world class.
What do you do during a concert?
What do I do? Well, I'm always in the concert hall. If I'm in the building, I'm in the concert hall. I will not sit at my desk during concert. In fact, I used to love to be backstage all those years doing all those other jobs. I spent a lot of time backstage, and I miss that, but I'm out in the house. I'm with the audience. I'm with my patrons. I'm in the donor lounge, thanking and getting to know all those people who make our work possible by making these very generous donations. Engaging with them, but when the music is playing, I'm getting my relaxation. I'm getting my therapy for the hard work that I do all day long. It's my moment to get the gift back that the players and the conductors and the soloists and that experience can give. And I really eat that up. I love the concerts. They just make me feel better. And my brain works too. My assistant will laugh if she's listening to this, because she knows I come in the morning. I've got all these notes all over whatever pieces of paper I happen to have brought in. And sometimes I have a notebook that I write in, because my brain starts to work when I'm listening to concerts. Back to what you asked earlier about kids and the effect of music, I really believe there's something about music that makes you function better.
When we come back, we'll ask Anne about the 4-square-block area in and around the symphony. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Ann Parsons and the 4-square-block area. It's a shining model of the rebirth of Detroit. Talk about it.
Well, I'm glad you said that because that's I feel that pride associated with the work that was done by the Detroit Symphony and the community. And this goes back to saving Orchestra Hall all those years ago. Visionary to not let one of the great concert halls of the world be destroyed. And it is one of the great concert halls of the world. Every conductor who comes in will say that and marvels at it. And we're so lucky to have this hall. But it wasn't enough to have a great hall. We needed to have a neighborhood, and we arts organizations, and I think particularly in Detroit, all of the art, the cultural organizations take this issue of redevelopment very seriously and are participating in it in an important way. And the Detroit Symphony is just one of many examples of the Midtown cultural organizations taking action and restoring their facilities. So we felt it was very important to pursue our mission of education, and we partnered with the Detroit Public School System and Detroit Public Television in creating the complex that's just behind our block, not on Woodward, but on the back side of the hall. And there's a beautiful performing arts high school there from the Detroit Public School System, and we partner with them. In fact, our guest artists go over and give master classes, and the kids come and watch rehearsals, and this happens on a regular basis. And then we have our own civic ensembles program, and part of our expansion was to create an education center. The Bernard Pincus Education Center houses 500 young people a week that we, the Detroit Symphony, train in jazz and in classical music. And so the vibrancy of our block is about youth as well as the patrons who come on a given night to hear the concerts, which, as we've said before, are not just classical concerts, but we believe in being a community center. So things happen there. Corporations will come in and do a product launching. We've had several of those occur in the building. Because we've got facilities now that welcome in a community. There's parking, easy access, it's safe, it's clean, and it's beautiful. So you can come for music, but you can also come for other reasons. The Community Foundation was in the other day launching an initiative and using one of our facilities. And so it's education, community, engagement, music, they're all coexisting together. And sometimes they coexist at the same time, because Orchestra Hall can be having a concert that the Detroit Symphony will be putting on, while a corporation or a foundation might be in the music box, or another arts organization presenting something that they're doing. Mosaic uses our theater. Lots of chamber music goes on there, contemporary music.
Every year, the Thanksgiving Day Parade. 15 months ago, the Super Bowl here in town. Last September, the Tigers playoff run. Those events brought people from all races, creeds, social economic conditions together. Mm. Music does the same.
Yes.
How does it do that?
And well, why? Music is universal. And while I like to speak about music as a language, and I think that one can learn it like one can learn a language, the words, the composers, how they express themselves can be understood without words. Therefore, one doesn't have to know a particular language to understand music. One can just go in and experience it. And so part of what creates barriers is lack of understanding and fear. And there should be none of that with music. So one can sit and listen to Yo-Yo Ma. Or we had Marcel Khalife in the hall the other day, and his music was very universal in its approach, and it was very beautiful and passionate, and it brings an audience together to share in the experience of listening to music, whether it's Mozart, Beethoven, world music, jazz. Again, I think that. There is a sense of community when you're in a room experiencing something together. And that's part of the beauty of the live concert experience. And it's why I believe, in spite of the wonderful changes in technology that enable us to hear music anywhere, at any time, this on-demand concept is important. And it's a way for music to live all the time in people's lives. And I encourage it. But There's nothing like the community of sharing the experience of a concert together.
Last Monday, you announced a new festival. You
yes.
alluded to it earlier.
Yep.
Can you share?
Can I share everything? I don't have time to share everything. We're so excited about this festival because it's going to talk about how music makes a difference in our lives, and it's going to give examples of how music has been a vehicle for expression. And sometimes our theme this year is creation out of conflict, and at the turn of every century have been fairly turbulent times historically. And so Peter Ungen's thought was to take that idea and talk about Beethoven's Fifth Symphony in the context of history and what was going on, talk about Stravinsky and his work, and then play it, engage the audience, and again, make it comfortable, not necessarily casual, but engaging in a way that's not come in, sit quietly, listen to a concert, leave. There's a place for that, but this festival is about engagement, and it's about maybe intellectualizing the concert experience a little bit and digging a little deeper and thinking about things and learning things and having fun. And we're doing it with jazz. We have Wynton Marsalis coming, playing the music from Congo Square, an incredible project that he's created that fits the festival perfectly. We have the classical with the orchestra. We have Kurt Vonnegut's text to Stravinsky's L'Histoire du Soldat, Soldier's Tale. And so the music is cutting edge. We've got contemporary music. We've got traditional classical music. We'll have partnerships with some other arts organizations, arts exhibits in the hall. We'll have some lectures. We'll show some movies. It will be a festival. And we're selling festival tickets. So you can buy a ticket and just come and go as you please. We've got a cheaper price, like $100 for an entire 8-day festival to come and go as you please, a real bargain. Also a higher level ticket. For a different experience, for a reserve seat. But the idea is that it's going to be different. It's going to be a little edgy, a little bit cutting edge, contemporary. But we believe it will be a way to introduce people or reintroduce people to the DSO and to everything we stand for and everything we're interested in pursuing. And we encourage people to try it. We think it's a new way to experience the orchestra.
Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
1 minute. He's telling me 1 minute. Well, I think it's simple for me. For all of us, we need to figure out what we can do to make a difference in the world, in our world. So it doesn't mean that we all will aspire to be the president of the United States. That's certainly one way to make a very, very big difference. But in your classroom, in your circle of friends, in your work, in your own personal dreams, while we all really do spend an awful lot of time thinking about ourselves and how to better ourselves, it should be for the goal of making a better world. And in order to do that, I think you have to think about what are your special skill sets, and everyone has one. Everyone has them. And how can you use them? And make it a better world, because it'll work.
Well, Anne, you're a shining example of somebody that's doing that.
You're
Thanks.
Very kind.
Thanks for sharing.
It's been fun to be with you.
Our guest next Sunday will be the fastest gun in the West, Wyatt Earp, Hugh O'Brien. Until then, I'm Jack Crisula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.